The drive to go further and reach higher. The same thing that inspires you inspires us. At Strayer University, we're always searching for new ways to make education more affordable. That's why we offer access to up to 10 no-cost gen ed courses to help you save time and money so you can keep striving. Visit strayer.edu to learn more. No-cost gen eds provided by Strayer University affiliates of Fuel Learning. Eligibility rules apply. Connect with us for details. Strayer University is certified to operate in Virginia by CHEV.
Amateur Traveler Podcast, Episode 43.
Welcome to the Amateur Traveler Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Today on the show, we go to Argentina. This episode is brought to you by Hotelbook.com, the official site of independent hotels worldwide. Hotelbook.com. Stay your way, stay independent. I'm going to skip the news section of the show today, possibly because I didn't find any interesting stories, and also because I have a longer interview today. I have an interview that I'm going to do in two parts, so we're going to do half of it this week and half next week. Okay, I'd like to welcome Jim onto the show, who just recently came back from a trip to Argentina, and invited him on to talk about the trip. Welcome.
Thank you.
First of all, why Argentina? Why did you go down to Argentina?
Well, I had been there 40 years earlier. I'd taken a leave of absence for 18 months and traveled throughout all of Latin America. And I really enjoyed Argentina. I was thinking that this would be a good time to take my wife down there and show her around. We had originally thought of going to parts of Peru and Brazil also, but we decided to just narrow it down to just an Argentine trip. The opportunity came up in November of last year when United Airlines had this terrific round-trip deal for $6.99 round trip per person, which is about $300 off the regular price. And then they also threw in 5 free days at a hotel there in Buenos Aires. So that was the clincher that allowed us to be able to make the plans. I had asked, what do you have to do to be able to stay there longer than 5 days? And they say, well, stay another month. So we did, and that way, why it was worthwhile going down there, because otherwise you just spend all your time traveling and you're just worn out and you don't enjoy anything. But we made our travel arrangements so that we were able to leave the 1st of March and then return by the 4th of April, and so it was very, very eventful, because we were able to spend our first 5 days kind of getting oriented in the country and getting used to the language and getting used to the currency. And of course, Buenos Aires was my favorite city when I was traveling, because it wasn't necessarily a touristy city, but it was just a very, very comfortable city to live in. It was very easy to get around. The people were friendly. The food is outstanding, and it's safe. And so we were able to use the Waldorf Hotel as our base. And then as we traveled to the south and to the north, or to the west, we were able to leave much of our luggage right there in their storage bin. And that way we were always able to get off the plane with our luggage, jump in a cab without having to go through the check-in and check-out system that they had. So, and Aerolíneas Argentina had very, very good service. We managed to miss by a few days some of the strike that they had, because Argentina is always fighting inflation and people are always crabbing about their money not going very far. So we were able to always make our connections. We never had any canceled flights, and so that aspect worked out really well. Our arrangements were just absolutely superb. And I didn't realize how good they were until I saw how my wife is sweating it out in just arranging a 10-day trip to Europe, because it took me maybe a total of 3 hours of consultation with one of the agents there at AAA, And what I had done was I mapped out 6 days in Buenos Aires and 4 days in Calafate, which is the entrance city to the glacier country.
Okay.
And then four days in Ushuaia, which is down south of the Straits of Magellan. And then another 4 days in and around Buenos Aires at a dude ranch, which is called an estancia, and also then we were able to make another connection to go down to the lake country, which is Bariloche, for 4 days, and then another trip from there directly up to Iguazu, Iguazu Falls on the Brazilian border, for another 4 days. And then we would make another 4 days over to Mendoza, which is the wine country over by the western Andes. And then come back to the city to spend some days in a suburb called San Isidro, which is one of the older suburbs, which has very charming places to visit. So it was I made all this out, and then the travel agent uses a travel agent of their own called Avanti to make all these international connections.
Mm-hmm.
And so that company made all the arrangements to have us be picked up at the airport and taken into a hotel that they had made arrangements for, and then that same group then would come and pick us up and take us back to the airport. And supposedly there were tours going on every day with Avanti, but we never saw any other group of people. We basically were traveling on our own with all the reservations and all the connections made in advance. And it was seamless. It was just really terrific because we always allowed one extra day in each city just to be able to do whatever we wanted to. Sometimes we lined up a day trip through Avanti, and sometimes we lined up just a local trip on our own.
Mm-hmm.
And that way, while we had a lot of options and we had a lot of freedom, and that makes the travel fun because you tend to kind of back into really special places.
And what stands out? What are some of the special places that really stand out?
Well, we pretty much had two special times every day. That's the hard part, because we went down to we found that just around Buenos Aires, the two big things the tourist people are promoting are the tango,
sure,
and La Boca, which is an old Italian tenement during the turn of the 20th century, or the beginning of the 20th century, the country was almost doubled in size by Italians. So you had this identity crisis for the Argentines for about a 60-year period where they didn't know whether they were Italian or Spanish because there was this very, very definite rift between the two cultures. And La Boca was where the tenements were, and they've kind of jazzed that up and turned it into just an incredible tourist trap, which to me I thought was very uninteresting. But we did take tango lessons, so we did meet this very, very knowledgeable fellow who had worked with Intel, of all places, for several years before his marriage fell apart and he went back to Argentina and was a walking tour director. And so he took us on this really neat walking tour of Buenos Aires and up through the very fashionable areas and up to Recoleta, which is a big park and outdoor eating area right by the cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a special place to visit. We used to just kind of hang out over there and sit and write postcards that's the neat thing about Buenos Aires. There's thousands of outdoor restaurants. And everybody waits on you. You don't have a stand-up line. You don't have to cart your food out. You don't have to bus your trash. You know, they just take care of you, and you can stay there as long as you want. And the climate was, the temperature was just perfect for us. It was the beginning of fall. The leaves were changing. The kids were going back to school, and it was just a really pleasant time to be there.
Now, you went. You saw a variety of climates, though, and as you start to describe where you went down to Patagonia and then even further south to the Straits of Magellan.
We did.
So When you got that far south, what was the weather like?
It really wasn't that bad. Okay. It was pretty much like being on San Francisco's Golden Gate Bridge during the summertime.
Okay.
We were lucky. We had been toying about.
Which is to say, cold and windy.
Cool and windy.
Yeah.
But we were prepared for it, and we were dressed for it, so it was fine. The thing that we lucked out, and I'm glad we made the decision to stay in Argentina, because we wanted to go to the Paines National Park in Chile.
Mm-hmm.
But our friends had gone there, and they could barely take pictures of it through the rain. And as it turned out, our experience all along the southern Andes were the rains are almost all the time on the Chilean side of the Andes, and they only creep over the mountains in the afternoon on the Argentine side. So you get a half a day of brilliant sunshine, and that's the beauty, because those mountains are just absolutely spectacular. They're very, very heavily eroded, glaciated. The glistening of the glaciers, the snow peak, the peaked mountains, the beautiful lakes, the lovely cloud formations. It's just absolutely spectacular. So when we were down at Ushuaia, which is down at the Beagle Channel, which is about 150 miles south of the Magellan Straits,
mm-hmm.
That's where Ushuaia is, and they bill themselves as the southernmost city in the entire world, and they discount the fact that Williams, which is across the channel to the south, is in Chile, but it's just a military town, so that doesn't count. But there's an awful there's a tremendous rivalry between the Argentines and the Chilenos, and they bickered over the island that made up Cape Horn. I'd always thought that Cape Horn was right at the end of that point of South America,
mm-hmm.
but that's not Cape Horn at all. There are three little islands to the southwest of there, of which the southernmost island is Cape Horn.
Oh, I didn't know.
And it wasn't named over the shape of the island Tierra del Fuego.
Mm-hmm.
It was named after the captain's hometown of Horn, Holland, which I thought was really unbelievable. So now it's a national park now. It belongs to Chile because the Pope had to decide who it should belong to in the mid 70s, because Argentina was ready to go to war over these three little uninhabited islands.
Huh.
But that's pretty much the nature of these. That's the problem when you have two isolated countries that are relatively well off, and they're just constantly bickering among themselves. The big joke with us was that whenever there was something near the border, not a whole lake could belong to Argentina. Half of it had to belong to Chile. Not a whole estuary could belong to one country. It had to be divided in half. And so you're constantly, it's very tricky to get across the Magellan Straits because you're constantly going from one country to the other, back to the other country again. We did find that Chile actually had the first chance to take advantage of that part of the world because they had the settlement at Punta Arenas during the gold rush times, and that was a restocking place for all the people rushing to California.
Interesting.
And Argentina kind of perked up and decided, gee, maybe we ought to get a hold of some of this land too. And so they were kind of latecomers. As it turned out, they lucked out because the part of Patagonia they grabbed is where there's several major oil fields there now. So they actually export oil and gas to Chile, who has none, and so they're self-sufficient. So that was a surprise to me because we were able to fly over several of the oil fields on our way down to the south. The problem with most of Argentina is, especially south, is that between about 400 miles south of Buenos Aires, all the way down for the next 1,000 miles, it's like flying across central Nevada. It's very, very uninteresting countryside. The Patagonia is a series of plateaus and windswept plains. They call it steppe, but it's basically just sheep country. But you get up close to the mountains then, and you have the same kind of configuration of the landscape as you would have in in Washington State, where Lake Chelan is probably the best example, where at one end you have the you have the North Temperate rainforest, and at the other end is on the eastern end you've got desert, and that's the nature of most of the lakes there from Bariloche, which is 1,000 miles south of Buenos Aires, to all the way down to Ushuaia, which is about 1,600 miles south.
Hmm.
So you have a number of lakes down there that with high peaks, with lots of snow and lots of glaciers. The Pan American Highway has to go across the Andes right near Santiago to Argentina because the glaciers go right into the ocean on the Pacific side, and as a result, there are no roads that connect from Puerto Montt south. You have no roads going down to connect with Punta Arenas. You have to go to Punta Arenas, which is the main Chilean section of Patagonia, but you can't get there unless you go through Argentina or you go by boat. So anyway, it's all chopped up there. We got off the plane at Ushuaia, and it was just a beautiful sunny day with lots of scattered puffy clouds, and the guy that met us said, do you know where your hotel is? Are you aware that it's out of town? And we said, no, and she took us outside and pointed to it. And 1,000 feet above the city was this absolutely spectacular hotel that was below three glaciers.
Oh, my.
And we thought, oh, gosh, I mean, we're going to be stuck way up there in the mountains. And as it turned out, that was not a problem at all because we had several tours lined up, one tour to go out to see the penguins and another tour to go to a national forest, which was right at the end of the Pan American Highway.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were always on the go during the day, and then we would just take a cab back after dinner and coming up to the hotel after dark. But it was just really spectacular to open the windows every morning, watch the sun come up over this panorama of snow-capped mountains and waterscape and city under below us, and it was just really terrific. One day we decided to go on up behind the hotel where there was a ski resort, and we took the ski chairs up to the top, and just as we got, we had found out already, and we should have known better, but as you get closer to the glacier, you get into a totally different climate zone.
Sure. Colder, strangely enough, yeah.
About 200 yards from the top, the sun disappeared, the wind picked up to about 40 miles an hour,
oh,
and
my.
We got this absolutely thrashing rain right in our face. It was just awful. And it was so bad, it was just hilarious because, you know, we just couldn't believe that we actually intentionally went to a place like this. But when we came down, we decided, well, there was this really charming little tea house there right at the end of the parking lot there at the ski lift. And we decided to go over there and take a look. Well, it turned out it was the most romantic place you could possibly imagine. It was just this cute little cafe, and there were these old trees surrounding the tea house, and then you could look out over this tremendous panorama of all the mountains on the Argentine side and across the Beagle Channel to the Chilean side, and it was just, oh, the food was good, and the lady was, she spoke some English, and we just had such a nice time there. So that was a nice find.
Now, you brought up English. I'm assuming, since you had spent so much time down there, that you have some Spanish, obviously.
Yeah.
So were you getting by predominantly in Spanish or in English?
We predominantly got through in Spanish. I had lived in Mexico City for 40 years ago, but I was really tongue-tied the first 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
I really struggled with learning languages, but my wife was very good at understanding. I had a better speaking vocabulary. They had a hard time understanding my Mexican accent.
Oh, really?
I don't have an American accent. I have a Mexican accent, and they had to listen very carefully. They preferred to talk to me in English. So there were oftentimes we we exchanged bad Spanish for bad English. But we always got by, and we always got what we wanted, and there never, ever was any difficulty. I was surprised that there were so many people who were reasonably fluent in English,
mm-hmm.
that it was a very, very large population that was very well educated. This is one of the differences, I think, between Argentina and Mexico was that even though they're not particularly wealthy, because they got creamed about 4 years ago, they had an economic meltdown. They refused to pay back $100 billion to the World Bank. And as a result, why they ended up having to chop off at least one zero off their currency. So that pretty much halved the middle class, because if you had $5,000 in the bank, you now have $500 in the bank. And so there was about a 67% unemployment rate there for a while, and it was just absolutely dreadful. But while we were there, the news came out that they're down to about 14.5% unemployment. The gross national product, though, increased over 10% this last year. And one of the things that they're just starting to do, and it's always curious to me, because when I was there in the mid-60s, they considered themselves an emerging world power. And they saw themselves on an equal with most of the European countries. And a lot of it was just hot air. They really didn't have a clue what they had. And they were basically boasting about, well, we're very, very rich. We have tremendous natural resources. We just don't know where they are, which, you know, comes off as being awfully silly. And as it turns out, within the last 50 years, I got to thinking, you know, what is with this country that's been around for 400 years, and they really haven't found out a lot about their country until within the last 60 years or so, because most of the economy was based around the that region of the Pampa, where it was agricultural. It was developed by the British 100 years ago. They developed a lot of their huge amounts of capital came in from Europe and from England, to develop the railroad system and the port system there in Buenos Aires. And so you had this kind of a small enclave about the size of, say, from Iowa all the way over to Ohio, including Indiana and Illinois and maybe Kentucky. And that was basically what carried the entire country. And just recently have they even discovered that they really have a viable tourist industry that they're starting to develop. When we were down in the first time I was in Bariloche, there was a little village of around 12,000 people. Now there's 130,000 people there with a brand new, really first-class airport. And the same way with Calafate. Nobody in the world has ever heard of Calafate. But here's this really nice little airport about the size of, maybe a little bit smaller than Oakland Airport.
Okay.
Surprisingly enough. But that's the entryway. You're out on the desert there, and you drive 20 miles west, and you get to absolutely incredible glacier country. We were there during a very, very special time. It's probably the Patagonian ice cap is the third largest ice cap in the world after Antarctica and Greenland. So this ice cap extends for about 100 miles wide to about 300 miles long. And so from this you have these glaciers oozing through the mountains on both sides. And the most famous one in Argentina is called the Perito Moreno Glacier. And it happens to cut the largest lake in Argentina in half occasionally. Because it's coming in from the side, and then the glacier goes all the way across the lake. And so all the water that's at the upper part of the lake doesn't have an escape valve. And so the level goes up, 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 until finally the pressure's too great. It comes coursing through the glacier, and then the water equalizes again. Well, the day before we got there, the water above had punched a tunnel through the glacier. And so there's this huge course of water coming through, just an enormous current. And as it comes through, it creates its own wind and undercuts the glacier itself. So you have speeds all the calving of the glacier itself. So you have a lot of action going on right there at the toe of the glacier, and there are really nice viewing sites there. From either you can come in from both sides, and or there are trails that you can hike along to look at it from up above. So we were kind of hung around for about 3 hours because there's this huge slab that was about the height of us, of a 20-story building that looked like it was just about ready to come crashing into the water. Well, we missed it. But one of the national television stations had an eye on this glacier for about 4 days, and you just had some quiet talk in the background, and you just showed the glacier all day long, all the evening, all the next day. Because they were hoping to be able to see the collapse of the tunnel, and that would have been the great event. Well, we missed that. We had left by then, and 3 days later, it actually collapsed, and everyone was disappointed because it collapsed at night.
Yeah.
and nobody saw it. But in the past, it would be about every 14 years that you'd have this event occur.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the last time this occurred was in 2004, and now it's reoccurring again in 2006. So the whole action is speeding up quite a bit. Anyway, they did have tours that you could go across the lake and then do some trekking on the glacier itself. One of my friends from Southern California, who is from Argentina, she took her family down, and they had done that with a family last February, and they really enjoyed that. It's very, very interesting to be so close to a glacier because you can just see how incredibly spiky it is. You know, the very, very large, deep, narrow crevasses there where you're just, if you were to fall in, there's absolutely no way you could get out. But we were lucky. We went the day before. We had gone up the lake on the north side to three or four other glaciers, and one of them we actually stopped and then had dinner at this little nice little outdoor cafe, and then hiked across to a lake where there was a glacier at the other end, and it was kind of interesting to see all the small calves and the icebergs floating in the water.
Hmm.
And then we continued on around the corner to what's called the Uppsala Glacier. And this one is just an absolutely incredibly large glacier. And the thing that's really featured there is the fact that it has spawned such numerous large icebergs. And we were able to, because the wind was coming from that direction, the icebergs would blow towards us for about a 15-mile period. And as they go by, we'd be able to take pictures of them because they're absolutely beautiful. They're just an emerald. They're a sapphire blue with streaks of dirt in them, and just very, very pretty.
Hmm.
We didn't see this, but I understand that oftentimes, if you're lucky, you can actually see them actually turning, and when they turn, well, then you're just amazed because only one-fifth of the ice is above the water.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they do turn over, well, then you see how enormous the rest of the berg is itself.
Hmm.
But we felt really lucky because we had gone early in the morning, and we were able to see Mount Fitzroy, which is the tallest mountain in that area. It's about 12,000 feet. And it's very, very spiked on the top and just an absolutely spectacular mountain. And all that, of course, clattered up, and we weren't able to see that by 2 o'clock in the afternoon. But that seemed to have been the way things were on that side of the Andes. So we were glad we chose to go just on the Argentine side because you don't get the real beauty when you can't see anything.
Sure. That concludes the first half of the interview with Jim. I didn't want to cut off his interview and try and fit it somehow into the half-hour show I'm trying to make. I did potentially want college credit for all the things I was learning about Argentina, and that's true in the second half as well, as Jim talks about the jungle and penguins and waterfalls and disputes with Brazil, so stay tuned for that next week. A reminder to those of you who are listening to the show, even occasionally on iTunes or on a iPod with video or a photo iPod, there is a enhanced version of this show available on the Amateur Traveler website, amateurtraveler.com, or in iTunes that will allow you to have pictures. And specifically for this particular episode, the pictures of Mount Fitzroy and of the glaciers, the two pictures that I found for that are very spectacular. I'm going to skip over the internet resources portion of the show today just because there's too much going on and the show is already getting a little long. I would like to remind you that some of you heard an ad before Worf introduced the number of the show today, and if you did, that means you're listening to an old feed of the show. I'm trying to get everybody on the new feed, and I still have 100 to 200 people off on a Fruitcast feed instead of a feed burner feed. So if you have a way to check that, or if you want to just unsubscribe to the show and resubscribe, you'll in iTunes, for instance, you'd get the correct feed. The correct feeds are also on the website. There is a 50th show apparently coming up in not all that long from now, and I'd like to get some help from the listeners to start planning that. I don't know what I'm going to do for that. I'm not thinking I want to do a retrospective show because I've heard all that before, so I'm not sure if there's anything in particular that I want to do to recognize the 50th show and the one-year anniversary of the show that are coming up, but I'm interested in your ideas. You might want to post those on the discussion boards, amateurtraveler.com/board. Also, please follow the link to comment on this show, on this episode, or give me ideas for future episodes. I'm always looking forward to that. I'll also put a link on the show notes to a post about home exchanges and potentially doing home exchanges. Someone had suggested on the boards that I talk about that. I don't know anything about it. I've never done it. I've always been a little afraid of that, and he gave some feedback about his experiences, so you might want to check that out. I also have an opportunity I want to pass along. I heard this week from Robin Sparks, the editor of Escape Artist Travel magazine, and she wanted me to let you know about this opportunity. She's organized a blue cruise on a classic Turkish yacht along the Turkish coastline this coming June 3rd through 10th. She says, I've had two cancellations open up, two slots I'd dearly like to fill. Because of the last-minute nature of the announcement, I'm offering $500 off for the first two signups, or if I get referrals for someone like you, she'd split that with me. Well, that would be very nice. But basically, it's going to be an amazing experience. Out of the over 24 countries I visited in the last 8 years, this is one of my favorite. I've also have airline booked, and spots on the boat are waiting. We'll be a small group on a big classic Turkish gullet. Joining us, the special guest is Traveler Tales executive editor Larry Haberger, who will be meeting daily with passengers, who is to discuss and practice crafting the personal travel tale. He's not only an excellent teacher, but he's a great publishing contact to have for anyone with a book in them. The regular fare is $5 short of $2,500. That's before the discount. That includes everything: drinks, food, transfers, sightseeing, writing classes, sightseeing, and much more, except airfare. And the airfare is running roughly $1,500, including the domestic flights. So if you want to drop me a line, I'll forward that off to Robin, or you could contact her directly, let her know that I sent you, and if you're interested in taking advantage of that opportunity. She only has the two openings, so they may go fairly quickly. The only other thing I'll say is I've recently got addicted to the multi-person virtual world called Second Life, so I'll be adding my Second Life contact information if you happen to hang out in Second Life, so you can run into me. I've been running into other famous podcasters this week. I've chatted with CC Chapman from Accident Hash. I've met the head of the Podcast News Network and chatted a bit with Adam Curry. That was a bit like a zoo because of the number of people that were there. So you might want to check that out. I'm Chris2X Pankhurst on Second Life. Thanks very much for listening. Stay tuned next week for the second half of the interview with Jim on Argentina. This episode was brought to you by HotelBook.com, which features nearly 5,000 unique and independent hotels in more than 140 countries. Whether it's a resort, a cabana, or a castle, HotelBook.com invites you to stay your way and stay independent. Visit HotelBook.com to see the latest destination deals with rates from $60 a night. From an upscale city hotel to a relaxing beach retreat, HotelBook.com will show you the best deals for that one-of-a-kind travel experience. HotelBook.com. Stay independent.
The best and the brightest served up daily by the sharpest minds in content delivery, Pod Show and Limelight.